This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Martin Rees. He's a fellow of Trinity College and emeritus professor of cosmology and astrophysics at the University of Cambridge. I spoke with him on May 9th, 2011, from the studios of APM in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was in Carnegie Hall Recording Studio in New York City. This interview is included in our show, Cosmic Origami and What We Don't Know. Download the MP3 of that produced show at onbeing.org.
Thank you much.
Okay.
You're welcome. And ideal distance between you and the microphone is about 6 inches.
6 inches,
or,
okay.
15 centimeters. Right.
Okay, so.
Depends how you look at it. it's comfortable for you.
Fine.
We'll be here for a while, so. Okay. Great.
Fine, yeah.
Can you hear your own voice through the headphones?
Hello.
Hello. Lord Rees?
Increase it.
Hello, Martin Rees here.
Hi,
hello.
Good. Krista Tippett.
Hello, hi.
Welcome.
Good to be on your show. Yes.
Welcome to this space, this media space.
Good to be here. I'm in New York at the moment.
Okay. You sound a little soft to me, which is something
I'm
noting.
You sound a bit soft
for
to me, too, so I don't know
okay.
if I can turn it up.
So I think we may need some volume adjustments, maybe on both ends.
Yep.
Can I answer any questions for you while they're doing that? Do you have any questions of me?
I don't think so. I gather we've got up to an hour and a half.
Yes,
altogether.
And
is that right?
We'll try to keep it closer to an hour, but we'd like to leave it leave some free space for in case that you know something unexpected
happens.
Yeah, well,
in fact,
happens.
I'm free till 11:30, so
okay.
It doesn't matter.
Right. That's great. Congratulations on the Templeton Prize.
Okay, thank you very much.
So Chris, he's still really soft.
Yeah, I'll give you some more.
Okay. My voice, I'm fine. I mean, I'm hearing my...
I can hear you all right.
All
but,
right.
Can you hear me?
That's better, yes.
Okay.
Okay. Let's talk about something mundane while they're dusting.
Can you tell me when we... Are we actually starting yet or not?
I think we... Now, Chris, he's quite loud. I want to ask you a mundane question before we actually officially get started while they adjust the volume.
Yes.
so they can get a sound check. So just tell me what you had for breakfast today.
Okay, well, I went to the... Sorry, I've got a frog in my throat.
Okay. Do you have some water there?
Yeah, I do.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
No, I was staying in. Oh dear, I was staying in some rather posh hotel and had a very big breakfast, which I don't normally have at home.
Mm-hmm. All right, and you know, we do get to take our time and we can edit. So if you need to stop and clear your throat, that's fine. And then we can get back to it, and we will, with the wonders of modern technology, we can make it sound like you didn't have anything in your
throat. Okay. Right.
Okay. So Chris, how are we doing? Can we start?
Christy, would you just talk for me one more time?
Yeah. You want to know what I had for breakfast?
Nope. That's good. I was just making sure I wasn't hearing you bounce back. So I think we're in good shape.
Okay. All right. Looks like we can go then.
Okay.
So let me just say one of the things I'd like to do in this conversation is talk about what's most important to you and kind of let people in on not just what you think and what you know, but how you think. And I think that from all of your writing...
Well, I try to think anyway. Yes.
But I also sense that's important to you that, you know, you've said science is not just for scientists. And I think that can be valuable.
Right.
And I'd like to start where I start with everyone, whether they are, wherever they are on the spectrum of atheism or religion, and just ask, was there a religious or a spiritual background to your childhood?
Not particularly. My parents attended church, but I don't think they had any firm religious beliefs. But I was exposed to the liturgy of the English church at the school I went to.
Right. It's, I think, something that's not so easy for Americans to understand, that the Church of England is a birthright as much as it's a choice, right? I mean, it's in the fabric of culture.
Well, it's true that... people who have no particular religious beliefs will say, if asked, that they are members of the C of E, mm-hmm. the Church of England. And, of course, some are firm adherents. But, of course, it does have a special role in our national life, as many TV viewers will have seen on the occasion of the royal wedding
recently. That's right. I remember I lived in England for a while, and I think maybe it was Anne Wilson, someone like that, who said, and I think a lot of people agreed with this, I don't believe in God, but I believe in the church.
Well, I think that is true, that many people who don't have any religious beliefs support the church as an institution, mm-hmm. And feel it's important for national occasions and would like to be buried according to its rites.
Yes. So tell me when and how cosmology captured your imagination. Can you trace that?
Well, it didn't happen early. I studied math and science at school and then at university, and I decided I wanted to do some kind of science as a career. And by a series of lucky accidents, actually, I ended up doing astronomy and cosmology. There were lucky accidents in two respects. First, I was fortunate to get a very charismatic advisor. And when you're starting a PhD, the key thing is to get the right person to advise and encourage you. And I was very lucky in that respect. And the second reason I was lucky was that this was way back in the mid-1960s, and that was the time when the subject was just opening up. The first good evidence that there was a Big Bang was coming online, the first evidence for black holes, etc. So it was a very good time to be entering a subject, because when the subject's new, the experience of the old guys is at a heavy discount, as it were, and it's easy for a young person who's committed to make an impact fairly quickly. And so I was lucky to be able to do that and to be in a good environment where I was able to make contributions to some of these new ideas.
And, you know, one of the ways you talk about one of the focus of your scientific passion, one of the things that occupies you is this deep structure of space and time, which is wonderfully intriguing language. And that's also what you mean by the deep structure of space and time is something even that amidst those great developments of the 1960s, no one had any idea, right, of many aspects of this.
No, well, that's right. I mean, there were lots of ideas which were speculative back at that time, which have now been settled. And, of course, the corollary of that is that there are many ideas which we now speculate about today, which could not even have been formulated 40 years ago. So issues like the overall scale of the universe and the fundamental nature of space and time, which people worry about now, couldn't really have been formulated back then because we just didn't know enough. So most of my work actually has not been on these sort of rarefied topics, but really trying to understand particular things we find in the sky to try and make sense of them, because we discover all kinds of extraordinary objects and we want to see if we can explain them on the basis of the physical laws that we think we've established here on Earth in the lab. So that's really most of what I've been doing, just as a geophysicist tries to understand the Earth and how it's evolved on the basis of what we know about physics and materials. So an astrophysicist tries to understand the things in the sky in terms of physics, and also, of course, to try and put it in some grand perspective. We know how Earth has evolved geologically and how life has evolved on it. But one thing that we then want to ask is, how did the Earth come to be? Mm-hmm. How did the Earth form? How did the Sun form? How can we put these in some grander cosmic context? These are the kind of things that I've been worrying about.
And I think even this idea that is as much a popular idea as perhaps it was a scientific idea, that space is empty. When the deep structure of space and time includes things that we really don't understand, right? I mean, with names for like deep dark matter.
Right. Well, one of the things we've learned is that in the universe, there's obviously stars and galaxies which are made up of atoms, which, so far as we know, are just like the atoms we can study in the lab. But there's also some stuff out there which is very important because it exerts a strong gravitational force, which is a kind of particle which we don't know about and haven't yet discovered here on Earth. So the nature of the so-called dark matter is a big issue for physics and for astronomy at the moment. But there's also another rather deeper mystery, which is related to the nature of space itself. There's evidence which has come about in the last 10 years or so that even empty space, when you take away all the dark matter and all the atoms, still exerts a kind of force. It exerts a sort of push or tension on everything. And this therefore means that even empty space has a kind of structure. And we don't understand that at all. In fact, most of us would guess that empty space does have a structure, but on a tiny, tiny scale, a scale a billion, billion times smaller than an atomic nucleus.
Huh.
And we would have to understand space on that tiny scale to understand its structure. We're used to the idea that you can't chop up any solid indefinitely, you get down to individual atoms. We now think that if you take space or even intervals of time, you can't chop them up arbitrarily. But the scale of the atoms of space and time, as it were, is much, much smaller than anything we can directly measure. So that's why this is a rather speculative area of science, because it's hard to relate the ideas to experiments, because they're so far beyond the range where we can do experiments. But there's fascinating ideas, and one of the fascinating ideas is that if you could chop up space on a very tiny scale, you would find that what we think of as just a little point in space is actually a tightly wrapped origami of extra dimensions. We're used to the idea of three dimensions of space, backwards and forwards, left and right, up and down. But if you looked at space on a tiny scale, you would find evidence for extra dimensions. Mm-hmm. The analogy that's often given of this is that if you look at a hose pipe from a long way away, you think it's a one-dimensional structure, a line. But if you get close up to it, you realise it's really got a thickness and is a three-dimensional structure. Likewise, we think that on this very, very tiny scale, there may be extra dimensions over and above the three that we're familiar with. And that indicates the mathematical challenge of trying to understand space at the very deepest level.
It's a mathematical challenge, it's also an imaginative challenge, right? I mean, it almost exceeds the capacities of human imagination to think about.
Well, of course, the human imagination needs to be channeled by experiments and observations.
Yeah.
And the trouble here is that we don't really have enough observations. But just to add a footnote to what I just said, many people believe that there are these extra dimensions which we don't perceive because they're rolled up very tightly. There's another idea which is even more fascinating, in my opinion, which is that there may be extra dimensions which are not rolled up. And indeed, this leads to the fascinating idea that there may be other universes, other regions of space-time, which are separate from ours because they're embedded in a common higher dimension. Mm-hmm. To give an analogy of this, I mean, if you imagine a whole lot of bugs crawling around on a big sheet of paper, they may think of that as their sort of two-dimensional universe. They can just go in two directions on it.
Right.
And then if you imagine another sheet of paper parallel to the first one and other bugs on that, then they think they're in a separate two-dimensional space and they're not aware of the third dimension, so they wouldn't know that there's the other parallel sheet. And some people think that one dimension up, we are in that sort of predicament. They think that there may be, as it were, another universe, maybe just a few millimetres away from ours. Mm. But if those millimetres are measured in a fourth spatial dimension and we're imprisoned in our three, we wouldn't know about it. And so that's just one way in which the space and time of our everyday experience may need to be transcended when we get down to scales both very, very small compared to everyday experience and to scales very, very large compared to everyday experience.
And it seems to me that another focus of your work on your thinking is finding ways to think about unifying the big and the small, right? Or understanding laws that might that they might have in common. Is that one way? Is that a way to say it?
Well, it's true that one aim of science is to understand the basic atomic structure of matter, and as I said, the structure of space mm-hmm. on a still smaller scale, and also to understand the cosmos. And these are really two separate domains of study in general, because on the micro scale, the basic physics involves the so-called quantum theory, the uncertainty principle, and all that, the idea that nature's slightly fuzzy on small scales, whereas on the large scales, the key theory is Einstein's theory, which tells us about gravity on large scales. And so the very small is the world of the quantum, the very large is the world of gravity and Einstein. And normally, we don't need to worry about these two things at the same time. I mean, if you're a chemist thinking about a molecule, you don't worry about the gravitational force between the atoms in that molecule because gravity is so weak on that scale. On the other hand, if you're an astronomer worrying about the orbits of planets, you don't have to take account of the quantum fuzziness in the orbits because the planets are so big. But if you want to understand the very beginning of our universe, the very earliest stage of the Big Bang, when everything was squeezed very small and dense, we do need to consider simultaneously both quantum effects and gravitational effects. And that's why we need a theory which does unify those two basic theories. Quantum theory and gravity are the two pillars of 20th century physics, but we now need in the 21st century to develop an all-embracing theory that combines the two.
And you've also said that that you want to bring that in addition to the cosmic scales and the micro world, there's a third frontier of the very complex. And you include, very interestingly, human beings on that frontier of the very complex, the most complex entities.
Well, first of all, I mean, human beings are the most complicated things we know about in the universe. I think if you talk to physicists, they sometimes talk about a unified theory of the very large and the very small, colloquially as a theory of everything.
Right.
They often use that phrase if you look at some popular books. And that's, I think, rather sort of hubristic and misleading.
Right.
The theory that they're seeking is, of course, an important intellectual quest. But if you ask what 99% of scientists are doing, they're not worrying about subatomic scales nor about the cosmos. They're trying to understand things on the everyday scale, especially things that are alive. Mm. And they're very, very complicated. And the challenge of understanding living things and complicated materials is a challenge of understanding the very complex. They're not held up at all because we don't have a theory of quantum gravity. And so most scientists are, of course, working on what I call the third frontier, which is the very complex. And this involves, you know, all the things in the everyday world, which are very large compared to atoms. Indeed, they're complicated because they have layer upon layer of structure in them. But they're very small compared to stars and planets, and therefore they're not crushed by gravity. So study of the very complex is, of course, what most scientists are doing.
I mean, you've made this provocative statement that it's possible to say definitive things about stars more than it's possible to say definitive things about aspects of life like dieting and childcare.
Well, indeed, I think even a small insect is much more complicated than a star, because a star is a huge ball of gas and it's crushed by gravity and is so hot that all chemicals are broken down into their atomic constituents. There's no complex structure, whereas even the smallest insect has a layer upon layer of structure, proteins, cells and all the rest of it. And so the smallest living thing is indeed more complicated than a star. And also, to go back to your point, everything about humans is very complicated. In fact, it may seem ironic that I can talk with some confidence about a galaxy a billion light years away and what it's made of, and I would hope that I can give you evidence so you take what I say seriously. On the other hand, you're very foolish if you take seriously what anyone tells you about diet or childcare, because they change their opinions, as you know, every year. It's not that the people working in those fields are less competent. It's that anything to do with humans and their behaviour and their environment is far more complicated than the cosmos or the microworld.
I want to ask you about something you said. I want to understand this better. You said that if Newton and Einstein are icons of unification, Darwin is the icon of this complexity that we're discussing. You've also said that the Darwinian pace of evolution and extinction is speeding up. What do you mean by that, and how do you measure that? I've never heard anyone say that.
Well, of course, we know that humans have evolved by a Darwinian process of natural selection over a time of nearly 4 billion years since the Earth was young, and species have evolved and become extinct, each species lasting maybe a million years or sometimes longer. But one important thing which we learn from astronomy is that the time lying ahead is at least as long as the time that's elapsed up till now. The sun is less than halfway through its life. The Earth has billions of years ahead of it, and the universe may go on forever. And I think this is very important to everyone, because this makes me very sceptical about any claim that humans are, in any sense, the culmination of evolution. Mm-hmm. We are, of course, the most complex organism that has evolved. But since the time lying ahead is just as long, then post-human evolution here on Earth and far beyond could be far more complex and wonderful than the biosphere we have here and of which we are a part. So that's just saying that there's plenty of time for Darwinian evolution. Darwin himself realized this. He said in one of his works that no existing species would survive into the distant future. Hmm. But the other point which strengthens this claim that we are not the culmination is that any future evolution of humans is not going to be determined by natural selection on the very slow timescale that led to our own emergence from the common ancestor of us and the apes.
Now, how do we know that?
Well, because it's going to be driven by technology, and we know
we are speeding it up.
We are speeding it up, and so any changes to humans will come about as a result of applications of genetics or cyborg technology, man-machine symbiosis, and things like that. And this can happen on the timescale of technological advance, which is far, far shorter. Mm. And indeed, this raises a number of questions. I think, first of all, the ethical question of how much of such experimentation should be allowed.
Right.
And secondly, whether it will happen, if not on Earth, perhaps when communities have escaped beyond the Earth. And of course, a few centuries from now, there may be small communities living independently of the Earth on other planets or freely floating in space. And I think if there are communities out there, then I would say good luck to them in modifying their descendants to be more adapted to that alien environment, using all the techniques that we will then have. So one can well imagine that on a timescale of centuries, the post-human era will begin.
Right. It's interesting to think about that because, you know, one of the things I've discussed with other scientists and also people who know Darwin is that one of the things that's hard about the theory of evolution for people to grasp is simply to think in terms of that magnitude of time, right? That the glacial pace defies our ability to accept these ideas. But then we're all living in this moment where, as you say, the pace of technology is not merely faster, it's dizzying.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's nice to imagine, you know, what would have been seen by some aliens who've been watching the Earth for its entire history. Suppose they aliens had for 4 billion years the iconic picture of the Earth from space, which we've, of course, had since the Apollo moon landings, mm-hmm. you know, showing mm-hmm. the Earth as a delicate blue planet in a dark background. We've had that image for 40 years. But supposing that some aliens have been watching us for billions of years, what would they have seen? They'd have seen very gradual changes as ice ages came and went and as species evolved and the vegetation changed. But then suddenly, a few hundred years ago, they'd have detected much more rapid changes due to the impact of humans on the environment. Mm. And then they'd have detected radio waves coming from the Earth, the integrated effect of TVs and radars and all the rest of it. They'd have detected an anomalous sudden rise in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere because of human activities. And they would have detected, amazingly, for the very first time in 4 billion years, little projectiles leaving the Earth and going into orbit around it,
all right.
The first spacecraft. And so they would have observed all these things happening in essentially a few centuries, which is just a tiny blip, because the Earth has existed for 45 million centuries.
All right. Right.
So things are really accelerating, and that makes it even harder to predict what can happen given the huge expanse that lies ahead.
So what we're, you know, all of this is evoking for me is also something that you, I think, are very articulate about, which is the way, without overtly being philosophical or theological or ethical, science, especially modern science, especially something like cosmology, raises insights and questions that are relevant philosophically, ethically, theologically.
Well, very much so. I mean, mm-hmm. I think we should distinguish the philosophy and theology on the one hand from the ethics, because obviously all the advances in science lead to a range of applications, some of which are benign, others less so. Of mm-hmm. course, we entered this era with the nuclear age in particular, and we're going to have more and more difficult choices as to how we apply science. So that we can benefit from it but avoid the downsides.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there are more and more issues where science is going to allow us to make choices, and we've got to make those choices widely. And this, incidentally, is one reason why it's very important that the entire wide public has some feel for science, because it shouldn't be just scientists who decide how science is applied. That's something for all citizens and politicians to decide. I mean, they've got to have a feel for science to make wise decisions. But separate from the applications of science, there's also the general way in which our perception of our place in nature is changed by
our
science.
Place
and
in
obviously,
the cosmos, yes.
Darwin changed this to some extent. And I think awareness that we are just one step in a very long-term process, which is not at its culmination, but maybe only at its halfway stage. That's, in my opinion, an important new insight that we in astronomy can provide to the wide inquiring public. Also, of course, the vast extent of the universe. One mustn't overreact to that last point, because we shouldn't be just impressed by size. It could be that, vast though the universe is, our Earth is a very special place. It may be one of the very few places where life has evolved to a complex biosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So the Earth, though tiny, may nonetheless be important not just to us humans, but on a cosmic scale. And this, of course, leads to another fascinating question, which is engaging astronomers now, which is the question of whether there is life in other parts of the cosmos. There have been very important developments in the last decade, leading to the awareness that most of the stars we can see in the sky aren't just twinkling points of light. Most of them are orbited by a retinue of planets, just as the Sun is orbited by the Earth and the other planets we're familiar with, Mars, Venus, Jupiter, etc. And this, of course, makes the night sky much more interesting, but also opens up the question of whether on any of these other planets life got started,
mm-hmm.
As it did here on Earth, and whether, having got started, it evolved in any places to complex life of a kind that we could recognize as intelligent. I mean, this is, of course, a staple of science fiction, but these are issues which are now an important part of science.
Right. So not only thinking, giving us perspective on our place in the cosmos, but raising anew the question of whether we are alone in the universe. that.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. yes.
It also seems to me that, I mean, you've also made some pretty dramatic statements that you think mankind has a 50-50 chance of surviving the century. Some said this is a scientific version of apocalyptic reasoning. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I didn't quite say anything as scary as that.
You didn't. All right. That's what was reported.
Well, I said a 50% chance of a severe setback to civilization.
Okay. All right.
I don't think we'll wipe ourselves out. I mean, that's very mm-hmm. unlikely. But I did say in a book a few years ago, which was called Our Final Century in Britain and Our Final Hour in America, that
we like things to
about,
happen more. Yes, it does. Our
well,
sense of time and history.
Well, that says something about the difference in the time spans that yes. Brits and Americans think on, perhaps.
Yeah.
But what I did say was that there were severe threats, and I did think it was only a 50-50 chance that we would get to the century having avoided them all. And, of course, one threat which we've been under for the last 50 years is of a nuclear catastrophe.
Right.
That's somewhat in abeyance with the end of the Cold War, because although there's a higher risk than ever of a few nuclear weapons going off in the Middle East or somewhere, there's less risk than there was in the 60s and 70s of tens of thousands going off and producing a real global catastrophe. But, of course, 50 years from now, there may be a new standoff between new superpowers handled less well or less luckily than the Cold War was.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one threat. But also, there are various other kinds of concerns we have in the 21st century, because the one thing which is absolutely clear is that the population of the world is rising, and that each person is making more impact on the environment of the planet. We're consuming more resources, affecting the climate, the vegetation, etc. And we've got to ensure that we don't produce a situation which irreversibly damages the Earth for future generations. So that's one set of concerns. But another concern I have is that I think the world's becoming less governable, because individuals are far more empowered than they were in the past by technology. The kind of people who now design computer viruses may one day be able to design real viruses. And in our interconnected
right.
world, even computer viruses can be more and more dangerous. And so I'm worried that a few weirdos or disaffected extremists can do far more damage in the future than they've been able to up till now, because they are more empowered. And to cope with this and ensure security without impacting on our freedom and privacy is, I think, going to be an ever-growing challenge to governments. So that's the sort of theme I had in this book.
Right. So, you know, I've thought a lot about a statement that Einstein made in the early 20th century as he, you know, to his great dismay, watched chemists and physicists create weapons of mass destruction. And he said that science in his generation was, he likened it to a razor blade in the hands of a three-year-old. And, you know, we know a lot about, we can look back on this moment of splitting the atom, and we can see that that had incredible destructive potential. I mean, it still does. Also incredible healing and life-giving potential. It occurs to me that and I wonder what you think about this moment in time where we're living through some of these choices and possibilities, as you say, like with climate. There's a great kind of awareness of the dual, of the double-edged sword of these things as they're unfolding in real time. I think what you're also saying, though, is that this doesn't just need to be a moment of scientists taking seriously the implications of their work, but that citizens, that everyone has a stake in this and also has some power over technology that previously was not so dispersed.
Yes, absolutely. Of course, Einstein's statement is even more relevant today. And
right.
I quote another one. H.G. Wells said that this century would be a race between education and catastrophe. Huh. And we've got to make sure that education wins. And indeed, the stakes are higher than ever before, in that the potential offered by science is, of course, brighter than it ever was, but the downsides are more potentially catastrophic. I mean, I think we shouldn't be too gloomy, because despite the risks and the threats that have hung over us for the last 50 years, I think there's no doubt that for most people in the world, there's never been a better time to be alive. Mm-hmm. There are at least half the world's population who are living a life that's been hugely transformed by modern communications, for instance. You know, mobile phones now pervade Africa and India to the tremendous benefit of the population.
Yes.
And that's a kind of economic growth which benefits the developing as well as the developed world, and also which is sparing of energy and natural resources. So let's not forget the benefits of the communication revolution and, of course, of improved health for most of the world's people. Of course, even now, we can see a big gap between what actually happens and what could happen, because we know that the world's bottom billion, living on less than a dollar or dollar and a half a day and without access to clean water, etc., could easily have their predicament alleviated if the will were there.
Right,
and
right.
I think it's deplorable. In fact, Jeffrey Sachs pointed out that the wealth of the 1,000 richest people on the planet could more than solve those problems.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't. And so I think this is already showing the gap between the way the world is and the way the world could be. And the concern is that even though the potential to make the world healthy, provide a good quality of life for everyone, feed everyone is being enhanced by science. Whether this will happen, of course, depends on political choices. And here, as you were saying, it's very important that although the scientists can provide the briefing, as it were, it's not the scientist who should be making these broader decisions, because when the issues get beyond science itself, they provide no special expertise, and any decision a politician has to make mm-hmm. Involves probably some technical or scientific elements, but it also involves economics, ethics and many other considerations where other members of the public have a right to an equal say. And that's why, as I said earlier, I think scientists do have an obligation to engage with the public and politicians to make sure that at least the decisions are made on the basis of the best science.
Well, and I wonder if we couldn't say that this also is a new, an evolutionary, like a cultural development, that you, for example, and others, as a scientist, as a public figure, you've made a conscious choice to not merely pay attention to cosmology's grand questions, but also to these earthly matters of social policy. I mean, you know, in your Wreath lectures, you give some, in addition to these issues that you just named, these huge issues of poverty, I mean, you named some very practical questions that our scientific advances are raising, that you know, you are advocating for a smarter, more thoughtful public dialogue about this. So, you know, how will lengthening lifespans affect society? Who should access the readout of our personal genetic code? Mm-hmm. Should the law allow designer babies?
That's right. These are all questions which the public should raise them on the agenda, because, of course, the other problem is that most of these issues which are important for the world and for society are long-term. And in politics, the urgent always trumps the important,
yes,
especially
yes.
when the electoral cycle is short. And so I think one thing that scientists can do is to raise their profile and make sure that the public doesn't forget these longer-term issues, because although in some economic decisions we apply a big discount rate and don't care what happens 10 or 20 years ahead, when we're considering the future of the planet, then we should surely rate the welfare of our grandchildren as high as our own. In other words, apply low discount rates. And I think scientists need to bang on about the importance of considering these long-term effects. So I think that is really something which scientists should do. But I think we have some good role models among scientists. I think among the most impressive individuals I've met in my life have been some of the great physicists.
Who do you think of?
Well, I mean, I'd mentioned two who I was privileged to know. One was Hans Bethe, who was a great physicist who died a few years ago at the age of 98. And he was someone who did great work in nuclear physics. Back in the 1930s, he was head of a theoretical division at Los Alamos during the World War II, the development of the first atomic bomb. But he went back to academia, remained a productive scientist until he was over 90 years old, but at the same time he was engaged in politics. He felt it was his obligation to help to control the power he had helped unleash, namely the power of the nucleus, and he devoted his energies throughout his long life to this aim, as did also Joseph Rotblat, another scientist who I was privileged to know, based in England. They, I think, set a wonderful example of citizen scientists by feeling it was their obligation to do what they could to ensure that their discoveries were benignly applied. Of course, they didn't have immense success. I mean, I think they are having success because it's now accepted that we should aim to cut down the number of nuclear weapons, if possible, to zero. In fact,
right.
Even President Obama, in his speech in Prague last year, said that.
Mm-hmm.
That is not now a mainstream idea. But I think scientists should exert whatever influence they can, even though they won't always succeed, and even though, of course, other opinions are also equally valuable. To give an analogy, if you're a parent, you can't necessarily control what happens to your teenage or adult children.
Right.
But you're a poor parent if you don't care what happens to them.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, a scientist's ideas, a scientist's creations are these new theories, and you're therefore a poor scientist if you don't care about how your creations are applied. And so that's why scientists, I think, have a special obligation to express concern and to warn or encourage the wider public about the applications of the ideas which they understand better than anyone.
You are atheist, but have been very vocal about not seeing science and religion as adversarial aspects of human life. I also sense that you're kind of agnostic on the idea of whether that means there should be all kinds of dialogue. But one thing that occurs to me in this discussion we're having now about philosophical and moral quandaries that are presented by science is that, to me, it really heightens the challenge also for theologians, religious leaders who are keepers of these ancient traditions, which have moral reasoning at their heart, to also apply those and bring the depths of those into our public life in a different way.
Well, indeed, I think obviously all religious leaders need to be mindful of what we have learnt about the world and the environment and about life through the advances of science, and these people are quite rightly regarded as influential leaders of opinion. And certainly in my own country, we have the two leaders of the English Church are two individuals who I hugely respect.
Mm-hmm. And the chief rabbi who I've interviewed as well, who's weighs in quite a lot on moral issues.
Yes, mm-hmm. But I was thinking of the two archbishops as the ones who I most admire.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important. But I think there are people who are not in any sense believers in religious dogma, like myself, who are glad that there are these religious leaders who are speaking out. I should say that I'm not a person who adheres to any religious dogma, and I think the reason I can the reason I take that view is that if science teaches me anything, it teaches me that even simple things like an atom are fairly hard to understand. And that makes me sceptical of anyone who claims to have the last word or a complete understanding of any deep aspect of reality.
Right.
I think the most we can hope for is some incomplete and metaphorical understanding to share the mystery and wonder, whether we're believers or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so I find myself very out of tune with all dogmatic religions, which I suppose includes all the three Abrahamic religions, although, of course, I can see a closer affinity with Confucianism and systems of thought like that.
You know, although I did once speak with an Anglican theologian who's also a geneticist here in the United States. He's British, but he's an Anglican priest, and he said that he likens the creeds of the church to operational hypotheses.
Mm-hmm.
But
some people do decide to behave as if something is true, and they are, of course, entitled to do that.
Yeah. You know, I also see all kinds of interesting echoes. When we talk about, and I do think you agree with this, that I think we're kind of talking around this, that the insights, the perspective that science provides can be theologically and spiritually evocative. Is that?
Well, I think scientists share a sense of mystery and wonder,
mm-hmm.
With the less dogmatic religious believers, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
I think they provide an understanding of the natural world, which has to be incorporated in any system of religious belief.
I also, something that I'm very fascinated with in science, and it came out very loudly out again as I was reading all your many writings. This is not so much any kind of theological or philosophical principle, but there's a way in which scientific discovery there's a lot of wisdom in the history of scientific discovery, which is a template for life, even, as you say, this complex system of life, more than the way we pretend some of our other disciplines are rational, like politics or economics. So, for example, what I'm thinking of there is that progress in science is always implicated with failure or with the unsettling, the overt unsettling of what was thought to be real and true.
Absolutely. I think science doesn't advance in a very systematic way. It advances with sometimes two steps forward and one step back.
And you know what I'm saying? That's also how life is. But we kind of pretend in many of our other academic disciplines that it's all about that progress is this arrow forward, and science is very honest.
Well, I think that's true. And of course, although scientists aim to discover some sort of objective truth which can be shared across all cultures. And in that sense, science is the one truly global culture, in that protons and proteins are the same in China and America, as it were. The way they come to their conclusions and the way in which they prioritize particular areas of science does clearly depend very much on their culture. I mean, some cultures are interested in certain things, some are interested in a quite different set of things. And so the rate at which different branches of science advance, the way in which some are heavily funded and others aren't, that depends on all kinds of social factors. But the end point of science is something which aims to be objective. But I think, to go back to what you were saying, I would agree with you that there's a great similarity between the way scientists think and others do. I think there's a lot of pretentious talk about the scientific method as though it's something special. But I don't think there's anything different between the way a scientist thinks and works and the way, say, a detective works trying to solve a forensic case. You know, you're trying to assess the evidence and get things to fit into a pattern to decide how to weigh seemingly contradictory bits of evidence, etc. Mm-hmm. So I don't think the way that I think is anything different from the way people think doing any kind of deductive or inductive reasoning in any other walk of life.
Right, and that you may go in wrong directions, but in fact that those may reveal ways towards something that you couldn't see before.
Absolutely, and of course there are the sort of revolutions which overthrow a whole body of ideas. I think actually people slightly overstate how often these revolutions happen when we actually have to go back to the beginning. There are some. I mean, for instance, realizing that the Earth isn't the center of the universe, but the sun is. That was a big, big change. And I would say that the quantum theory was another big change. Mostly what happens in science is that new ideas are refinements and extensions of the old ones. For instance, I mean, Einstein didn't prove Newton was wrong. Einstein provided a theory which had a wider range of applicability than Newton and gave us a deeper insight into what was going on to produce the gravitational force. But Newton's theory is still good enough to program rockets to fly to the planets. It's not been proved wrong. And that's more typical, actually. Science advances and old ideas get absorbed into a more extensive field of broader applicability. And that, incidentally, is a good hope for science. But people sometimes worry about science getting so complicated that it'll grind to a halt because there's too much to learn. It's true that the amount of data is growing very fast and we need computer methods to analyze it all. But the aim of science is to unify disparate ideas, so we don't need to remember them all. I mean, we don't need to record the fall of every apple because Newton told us they all fall the same way.
Right.
And likewise, when you understand nature in increasingly general ways, then the number of separate things you have to remember goes down, not up. So that's why I don't think one should expect that science will grind to a halt for that reason. It may grind to a halt for other reasons, like some problems being just too difficult for us, but it won't grind to a halt because of information overload, in my opinion.
You've written that you agree with another cosmologist who said, humility in the face of persistent great unknowns is the true philosophy that modern physics has to offer. And, you know, there again, I think you're getting at human virtue as well as scientific virtue.
Yes, this is my friend Joe Silk who said that, and I think that's a very wise statement, yes. This is why I think we have to accept that there are many mysteries we haven't yet solved, we should be wary of people who have who make dogmatic statements. Sometimes people, especially more fundamentalist religious people, say, look, you can't answer these questions, can you? Isn't that a failure of science? And I think our response to that should be, indeed we can't. We are just beginners, and these things are very complicated. We must accept the uncertainty and not sort of accept some sort of flip answer which has no credibility.
Do you think so? You said you don't think science will grind to a halt because of complexity, but I do have the impression from some conversations with scientists that it seems, and to many people's surprise, that here at the dawn of the 21st century, where a couple decades ago it looked like some of these big issues would be tied up. I mean, does it seem like there are more unknowns or bigger ones at this moment, or maybe than you expected when you started your scientific career several decades ago?
Well, I think what happened in science is that as it advances, the frontiers, as it were, get more extensive and new questions come into focus just beyond the frontiers. Many of the issues that were debated when I was starting my scientific career have now been settled, and the issues we're now debating couldn't have been posed back then. So science is a progressive enterprise in that sense, in that the area of consensus grows and we can pose new questions. But I think at the same time, some areas advance fast and others advance slow, and we can't predict the rate of advance. I mean, this is true in technology, for instance. I mean, when I was young, I thought that we'd have bases on the moon now, and we'd all be flying in supersonic planes.
Did you?
And many people did. And, yeah, of course, we're not doing that because there was no economic or social motive to deploy the resources that way. On the other hand, I think something like an iPad would have been thought magic even just 10 years ago.
Yes.
And so the technology that's led to mobile phones and GPS and iPads and all that has evolved and disseminated worldwide far faster. So in technology, it's easier to predict the trend than to predict the rate. And some areas evolve fast and some slow. Mm. But as far as science is concerned, I think in my field, we have made rapid progress in a number of areas, but the one in which the progress has been fastest is actually in discovering planets around other stars. This is a field that didn't exist at all until 15 years ago and is now one of the most lively and rapidly developing fields of science. So that's developing faster, whereas some of the problems posed by subnuclear physics have been rather stagnating and haven't made as much progress as we'd hoped.
I mean, you know, in your Templeton Award acceptance speech, you named the bedrock nature of space and time and the unification of cosmos and quantum as among scientists' great open frontiers.
Yes.
And I think surely that might have surprised you 40 years ago to know that those might still feel like frontiers.
I don't know. I think we've got a lot more evidence because the trouble with those theories is that the ways of testing them are beyond the powers of any experiment we can do here on Earth. Mm-hmm. So we have to rely on indirect evidence to test our theories. But I think these theories are developing. I wouldn't like to bet how long it'll take. I mean, I think that going back to the problems in cosmology, I think that within a few years we may well know what the dark matter is made of. Mm-hmm. I think that's some sort of particle, we may discover it. But on the other hand, mysterious force in empty space, I think is going to be a bigger challenge. I would not be surprised if we don't understand that 50 years from now. I think that is a really big challenge because that clearly involves a very, very elaborate mathematics and also very delicate experiments.
You know, you very often in your speeches and your writing have used this analogy of science's frontiers of like the moments where ancient cartographers would come to the end of what they knew to be there.
Yes.
And they would inscribe there be dragons.
Yes, yes.
It also occurs to me, just as we're speaking, that right now it's sort of on television, for example, there's this, you know, there are all these there's a lot of programming and a lot of it actually being produced in Britain as much as the US that goes that is like this Game of Thrones, this new there's kind of semi science fiction, which is also evokes these places beyond which where, you know, there might be dragons. And I wonder if I don't know, I'm really thinking out loud, if that is in a sense kind of modern people somehow by osmosis as much as education perhaps picking up this renewed these renewed frontiers and mystery at the edges of human knowledge.
Well, I think science fiction and these computer games do, in a sense, nourish and extend the imagination. And you know, I tell my students that they probably do better to read good science fiction than second-rate science, because science fiction is more fun and no more likely to be wrong than the second-rate science. I think you're quite right in saying that many people are familiar through imaginative literature and computer games with ideas of worlds beyond our own, etc., etc. And I think this is a good thing because anything which broadens our horizons in space and time away from the parochial concerns which dominate the political agenda, I think is a very good thing.
Yeah, and I mean, even the notion of virtual reality perhaps making us be more receptive to some of these pretty far out things that you describe about perhaps these rolled up worlds, parallel universes that has always felt like the stuff of science fiction, but is looking more like there might be something to it.
Well, that's right, and I think the progress of science in the areas I work in is crucially dependent on, in effect, computer models in a virtual world or a virtual universe, mm-hmm. because we can't do experiments. We can only make observations, but we can do experiments in a virtual world of our computer. For instance, we understand quite a lot about galaxies because we can observe them, and we can also, in our computers, work out what happens if they're crashed together, for instance, crashing stars together, making stars explode, and we can do all this in our computer, speed it up a billion times compared to the real rate at which these things happen. So we can actually study these quite quickly. And then we look in the sky and see if the output of our calculation resembles what we actually see. And that's the way in which we can make progress. We can look at something in the sky. We can run lots of models in our computer and see which one ends up most closely resembling what we observe. And that's the way in which we gain confidence that we understand what's going on in a star or a galaxy.
It's really amazing, isn't it?
So the virtual world of our computer is crucial in advancing the subject, along with, of course, much better experiments. I mean, armchair theory doesn't get you very far by itself. We're no wiser than our predecessors were, but we do have much better instruments and much more powerful computers, and that's why this subject has advanced so fast.
So, you know, one of the things that I've thought a lot about in the past few years, as I've talked to people about this science-religion divide and, you know, redefining that, reframing that notion, is that there are these flashpoints of certain scientific ideas. You know, evolution is one, is probably the big one. But I think that we're just barely aware. We don't impose into those kinds of discussions the fact that in the 21st century, our lives are permeated with science and with scientific discoveries and other, you know, medical technologies that save lives and save the lives of our children and family members, that they all flow out of that same body of knowledge, that same capacity to use scientific instruments and reasoning of a few things that are frightening for people. I don't know, how would you react to that idea?
I certainly agree that some of the potential applications of science are frightening, and that's why we need wide discussion of the ethics and what should be allowed and what shouldn't. That's very important. But as regards future discoveries that may affect our worldview in the way that clearly Darwin did, I suppose one possibility would be understanding more about the brain and how our attitudes and emotions are determined. That'll be one. And, of course, close to my own field, if we did discover intelligent life elsewhere, that would make the universe much more interesting. It would require us to be rather more cosmically modest than we would have to be if we are the unique intelligence in the universe. But that's another thing that would clearly have an impact on general culture.
You know, I sense, I'd like to tease you out on this because it's not something that I've found you written about overtly, but you note that among cosmologists, people who deal with the universe on the scale that you do, astrophysicists, that the poles, and I think again these poles are what get us into trouble, but the poles are people who say, well, you study this universe and it's so unlikely that everything came together to create this hospitable biosphere, that there must be some purpose behind it, whether they call that God or not. And then there's another pole that says it's a random accident. It's an incredible, exquisite random accident. I sense that you want to assume a place that's somewhere between those two things, but I'm not sure.
Well, I think, obviously, the fundamental laws of nature are a mystery. One topic which I have written about is the question of whether there are many big bangs or just one,
mm-hmm.
the so-called multiverse idea. This does impact on what you've just said, because if there are many big bangs, then it's possible that each big bang gives rise to a cosmos governed by different physical laws, where the strength of gravity is different, etc. And if that's the case, then, of course, there may be universes governed by all conceivable sets of laws, and there will be some in which any specified fine-tuning will be fulfilled, and we naturally find ourselves in one of those.
Okay.
So one idea is that if there are many universes, and if they are governed by different physical laws, if, in other words, what we call the physical laws are just parochial bylaws in our cosmic patch and the fundamental laws at a deeper level, then these alleged coincidences would occasion no surprise. Whereas if those laws are indeed unique, then the fine-tuning that some people talk about mm-hmm. does occasion some surprise, and we just wouldn't know what to make of it.
So does that leave you more inclined to think of it as a remarkable accident? Is it?
Well,
or that there are ways to explain it as an as an accident?
Well, I regard this as a question which is a scientific question,
mm-hmm.
not a metaphysical question, albeit a very speculative scientific question. I think we do want to know how much is there in physical reality, as it were, beyond the part of the universe we can see with our telescopes. Does it go much further? Are there completely disconnected regions of space and time? And if so, are they all governed by the same physical laws? Or could it be that there are different physical laws, so that what we've called the universal laws are really just bylaws? And that, I think, is one of the important questions. And incidentally, I think when we have this unified theory of the very large and the very small and the nature of space, it will help to settle that question, because one of the key questions is whether there is, as it were, only one form of space or many different forms of space.
Mm-hmm.
That's an important question which string theorists worry about, and that is very strongly linked to this question of whether the things like the strength of gravity and the mass of the electron are universal, or whether they could in principle have different values elsewhere.
And do you rule out the possibility of, or if this unfolded in this way, would it for you rule out the possibility of purpose or of a I don't know, creative intelligence, or was Einstein mind behind the universe?
Well, I mean, I think, to be honest, I just don't understand what could be meant by purpose. I think if there was a purpose, I wouldn't expect human brains to be able to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is clear that humans are just a stage in the emergence of amazing complexity in the universe. I just think it's far too anthropomorphic to actually use the word purpose.
Okay. You have often said that you're atheist, but you do participate in the liturgies of the church, that you appreciate the ritual and practice of religious tradition. Tell me what that means for you as a human being.
Well, it simply means that I grew up in a culture where there was dominant religion, I am happy to participate in it, particularly because it is associated with a tradition of architecture, literature. We're just celebrating the 400th anniversary of the King James's Bible, for instance,
yes.
which is something which has had a general impact on British culture, obviously. The liturgical and musical and architectural tradition, which goes with the dominant religion in the UK, is something which I admire and would be sad to see decay. I appreciate participation in the services of this religion without accepting any dogma. And I'm sure if I'd been brought up in a different culture, I would have different views. I mean, if I was in the Far East, I might be a Buddhist and I wouldn't believe in a believe in a God or an afterlife of the same kind as Christians do. So I would say that I participate in this particular religious practice, but I see it as having no absolute primacy. It's just a culture in which I grew up.
Okay. It does strike me, it's always been interesting to me that about how scientists toss the word God around, though, even having said that, and you have echoed this question that Einstein would ask, you know, could God have made the world differently? Tell me what you think that is about. And clearly, I mean, even this famous Einstein quote of God does not play dice with the universe had nothing to do with God, right? It was not a theological statement or question. Yes. But so I'm curious about this. So what function does this word God play in scientific vocabulary? Well, how do you explain that?
Let me say, I think it's rather unfortunate that Einstein used the word God, because he meant Spinoza's God. He didn't mean the kind of God that that Christians believe. Just as incidentally, I think it's a pity that he called his theory relativity, because that led to all kinds of irrelevant cultural spin-offs into relativity and ethics, etc. Because, in fact, the essence of Einstein's theory is that the laws of physics are the same, observed in many different frames of reference. And so if he'd called it the theory of invariance, not the theory of relativity, that would have been an equally good description of what he actually discovered, but would have stymied those inappropriate extensions.
But I mean,
of
you know, even Stephen Hawking talks about God, and you know, so I'm saying even when people are dismissing the idea, it's a word, it's a concept that somehow finds its way in even to a scientific vocabulary.
Well, I think it's better if they don't use it. I mean, I think because I think they mean different things by it, and I think it only misleads people if it is used in a rather ill-informed and unsophisticated way by some scientists.
Well, let me ask you this: when you are participating in a Church of England service, and the word God is in those prayers in the Book of Common Prayer that you recite as part of a community, you know, what? You're right. All of us. I mean, everyone. I can't pronounce this. There's an anthropomorphic tendency. You know, we imagine something that's close to human experience. I mean, what do you imagine when you read that word?
I just can't imagine anything.
Okay.
I mean, I think it seems to me that we are part of this world, many aspects of which are mysterious. Perhaps the most mysterious is that we exist and are conscious and able to wonder about how we came to be here. But I regard the rest as a mystery, and perhaps it'll have to await the evolution of some species more advanced than humans to make more sense of it. So it is just a mystery to me.
Hmm. You just mentioned consciousness, which is part of what makes us think about something like God or want to understand the nature of stars. Just curious, you know, I see that as one of these huge frontiers of our time. How do you, as an astrophysicist, a cosmologist, observe that development and think about its possibilities? Well, does it inform what you do and how you make sense of it all?
Well, again, I think the brain is the most complicated thing we know about in the universe, and we are just beginning to understand it. And there are lots of ideas, of course, but that is, in my view, you know, the sort of Everest problem, as it were, the highest summit in studying the complexities of our world, and how far we will get in solving that, I don't know. But there are many mysteries still, obviously. But again, the point I want to emphasize is that we should not be surprised that there are many mysteries, because we are just beginning and the world is very complicated, and our brains may not be up to solving all of them.
I just want to say, I think it's quite remarkable for you, as someone who does have some sense of what happens in galaxies far, far away, to still call the brain this Everest of science.
Well, it is far more complicated, yes.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, is there anything we haven't talked about? Anything or any place that we touched on and you didn't get to finish a thought?
Well, I think we've had a fascinating conversation,
yeah.
But I could go on for hours. I'm very happy to go on chatting.
It has been
But your listeners may have limited patience.
Well, no, it has been a fascinating conversation, and I just want to look back at my notes and see if there's anything we didn't... I mean, it's been fantastic. Let's see. I think we really did. Well, let me just ask you this final question. We have talked about technology in many contexts, in terms of speeding up human evolution, the tools and instruments that it gives you to do your science. I also kind of want to ask you the same question I just asked about, you know, the field of the study of consciousness and. How has this emergence of technology as we know it, you know, how does that, maybe you've answered this question already, but how does that then enlarge your imagination, change your imagination, perhaps in ways you didn't expect, as someone who studies the cosmos?
Yes. Well, first, it's important that there is a sort of symbiosis between technology and science. I mean, there's an old and now discredited idea that scientific discoveries are made and then they're applied to technology. It's not like that because the technology allows us to do new experiments and discover new science. So there's a kind of symbiosis. And in particular, in my subject, which depends on the technology of telescopes and spacecraft, etc., it's a technology which has allowed us to make the discoveries, and also, of course, the computers which have allowed us to analyze the data and do modeling. So there's a symbiosis, and I think if we look ahead, we are going to see huge further advances in computer technology and robotics and miniaturization. This is going to enhance our intuition in many ways. I mean, already the fact that we can do experiments in our computer and play around on a computer, like in computer games, is a way of developing our intuition. It's an aid to thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one of the reasons I'm optimistic about us continuing to develop a deeper understanding of the natural world is that we'd be aided not just by obviously more precise and elaborate instruments, but by these interfaces between our own brain and some silicon brain, as it were, which are going to help us. And these interactions become more close and more sophisticated. And I think that's going to be a fairly rapid change if we just think of how much there's been development just in the last 10 years.
I'd also just love... I mean, the other thing technology does is it makes, probably for with ill potential and good, it creates a new possibility for the interface between large scientific ideas. And I mean, this egalitarian pull of a technology can work in this way as well. I loved a story you told about, and I think this is how something can be gained in popular translation that then can help, then can be valuable to scientists. You told a story about Robert Wilson at Bell Labs detecting weak microwaves that are a relic of the Big Bang, but that he didn't appreciate the full import of what he'd done until he read a journalist's description of what he had detected as the afterglow of creation.
Yes. Well, I mean, that raises two points. One is that, of course, scientists obviously are aware of the big problems, but they don't tackle the big problems head on. They work on a problem which they think they can solve. Peter Medawar, one of my scientific heroes, said that no scientists get credit for failing to solve problems beyond their competence. They earn at best the kindly contempt reserved for utopian politicians. Scientists tend to work on a sort of bite-sized small problem. But the occupational risk then is that they forget that their small problem is worthwhile only because it's helping to illuminate the big picture. And I thought that anecdote about Robert Wilson was rather nice because he made one of the greatest discoveries of the century. But the way he did it was by tinkering with the antennae of a radio dish and making sure he'd got rid of all the background, etc. He was doing detailed technical things. And he was so focused, obviously, on doing that, because that was his expertise, that it didn't really sink in what a great discovery he'd made. And so that's why I think it is important for scientists to engage with the public, because if you talk to a general audience, then the questions they ask are, of course, the big questions. They don't care about these tiny technical details. If we talk to the public, they remind us that the big questions are important, and also they remind us that most of those big questions haven't yet been solved. We've made progress in the small components of the question, but we haven't solved the big ones. So I think that is an important lesson.
Well, Professor Rees, thank you so much. This has been really fantastic. I'm seeing a producer ask a question behind the glass. Let me just listen in my headphones for a minute.
Two questions. Mm-hmm. One is that he stated how he's had an affinity for Confucianism.
Yeah.
And that's something interesting, might be appealing. And also, I'm just kind of curious that what we know is we're receiving a lot of atheist non-believers, unchurched, mm-hmm. who respond to us, and they're kind of longing for places to talk about that wonder and mystery.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if maybe if he's aware of dialogues going on out there, spaces, ways of talking about that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, just two quick questions, you mentioned that you... you're somewhat attracted to Confucianism. Is that a...
No, I didn't really mean to say that.
Okay.
I just meant that, I grew up in a culture dominated by Christianity, which, of course, has a dogmatic theology.
Mm-hmm.
If I had grown up in the East, mm-hmm. I would be exposed to Confucianism. And, of course, let's not forget that that is in a sense, a religion, but it doesn't have any of the ingredients that the Abrahamic religions
have. Right, it doesn't have that transcendent component.
No, mm-hmm. it doesn't. And mm-hmm. I think this is why I was perhaps slightly reluctant to get involved in talking about God, because, of course, Confucianism is thought to be a religion, but it has no afterlife and no God. It's a way of life. It's a way of life and a way of looking at the world.
Yeah.
And so I think if we are talking about religion, let's not forget that that is a far broader concept than one which is based on the religion we're most familiar with here in the West.
So the final thing I want to talk to you about is, you know, this program I do is called On Being, but we have very much a focus on, we say, meaning, religion, ethics, and ideas. And, of course, our religious traditions are carriers of traditions of meaning and moral deliberation, and they are these vast repositories, our central repositories. We have a lot of listeners who are atheist and agnostic. And, you know, they have ethical lives and they have spiritual lives. I think it depends on how you define that. But they're asking these questions of meaning. It has felt in recent years that it was hard to that there wasn't much middle ground. There's middle ground in people's lives, but in our public life, right? There's the new atheist revival, or there's religion. I think that you are very clearly an atheist. You even wish scientists wouldn't use the word God as much, even metaphorically. But I think you are also arguing for some kind of different space for seeing the relationship between these things, or at least defusing the idea that the relationship is adversarial. I wonder if you would just speak to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd say two things. I mean, first, there are some very distinguished scientists who do have traditional religious beliefs. I know a number of them. I find it hard to understand how they can adhere to these beliefs in the way they do, but plainly they do. They have these beliefs, and we must respect them, and we should not in any sense believe that they're less good scientists for that reason. So we should accept that there are many scientists who do have religious beliefs of all kind, as well as many who don't. But the other point I'd make is that even many of us who don't have religious beliefs favour the idea of, as it were, peaceful coexistence.
Okay.
Stephen Jay Gould had a rather pretentious name for this called non-overlapping magisteria.
Right.
This is really the idea that you can have a religious discourse and you can have a scientific discourse. I mean, science is an area of mental activity which is based on experiment and mathematics, and I would say just as mathematics is the language of science, music is the language of religion. It's a quite different kind of thing.
Mm.
I think I am a person who believes in peaceful coexistence between these two different realms. And that's okay, of course, provided one is not dealing with creationism, etc., where people are led by some religious dogma to make claims that are manifestly incorrect about the real world. One has to fight against that strongly. And it's rather interesting that there was a survey done of members of the Royal Society, which is a British Academy of Sciences.
An august institution, which you led.
Of which mm-hmm. I was recently president.
Mm-hmm.
It was a rather incomplete survey. Only about a quarter responded, so I don't know how reliable it is. But of those who responded, only a small minority were believers in a personal God in a traditional way. But more than half of them believed in peaceful coexistence.
Okay.
So, in other words, the sort of strident view that one should be hostile to religion, a strident view which is espoused by a few high-profile scientists, is one which they, of course, deeply share, but they should not regard that as being typical of non-believing scientists. Many non-believing scientists, like myself, do not wish to attack and deride religion in the same way. And indeed, one of my disagreements with these people is that I regard fundamentalism, both Christian and Islamic and New Age, as being a real danger to the world, and I therefore think we need all the allies we can muster against it. And I would see the mainstream religions that have no problem whatever with science, as being our allies in this battle. I mean, all the allies we can get. So to rubbish the leaders of the mainstream religions, like in my case the Archbishop of Canterbury, seemed to me counterproductive from any point of view.
And, you know, I'm not sure you would take it this far, but as I suggested before, I actually think that your encouragement as a scientist, what did you say, a citizen scientist, of more mm-hmm. rigorous, vigorous public deliberation of some of the really big moral issues that scientific discovery raises, as I said, I actually think that theological thinkers and people who mine these vast repositories of moral deliberation that our traditions have carried forward in time, I mean, in a way, it invites and asks them to play a more vigorous role.
Well, it does, but of course, most of the scientists who believe it's important to engage in these public discussions are sort of secular scientists.
Mm-hmm.
I think in many cases they have made a more successful effort than, for instance, the Catholic Church, which has, on environmental and other issues, not been on side with some of the concerns of the scientists.
Mm, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. So I guess we won't resolve that in this conversation, but it's been really delightful speaking with you and I thank you for your time, and we'll let you know what's happening with this and send you a CD.
Okay, well, I hope you get something useful out of
that. Oh, yeah, we absolutely got something useful. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Right, goodbye.
Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.